you don't read a book and just scream. But when you're listening to a podcast, even if you don't say anything, you really feel provoked to say something verbally.
You know, they think they're not gaining writing skills that are practical. Not true. And I've, from my class, my one class in the past at least, I have seen that. They improve so much as writers after they're forced to write the podcast, because you're forced writing a podcast to make relatable language.
I mean, I learned to listen to my voice, so that was nice. That was a cool thing to have to deal with, whether I wanted to or not.
And I think the podcast teaches what listening can mean.
I mean, I think because, like, just like the same vulnerability you feel in a traditional writing class is amplified because it's your actual voice.
I feel they feel so, it sounds stupid, but they feel so real to me when I hear them, and I just think about the complexities of their lives just from their perspectives. I'm like, oh yes, being a freshman, you're talking about how confused you are right now, or how much you're struggling, or how homesick you are. And there's something about hearing them express all those different things in their voice that, even though I'm not talking back to them, it just feels, there's something about it that feels a little more personal and a little more vulnerable.
In her new stuff on what she, I think brilliantly, calls deep writing, Deborah Brandt offers me a new posture for learning to think through this unwieldy work of writing. She says so simply that we now write to other writers. And the implications keep swirling around in my own writing and teaching, and certainly in the ways I approach program administration. Because here's the thing, watching these students struggle through a podcast project showed me, more concretely anyway, that the distinction between an active writer creating for a well-behaved and passive reader no longer makes all that much sense. The podcast necessarily implies an active conversation partner, a reader who is actually a sort of writer who talks back, who shares the podcast so that it circulates and circulates and recirculates. I guess that this keeps showing me that we really do need, like Brandt makes wonderfully clear, to honestly reconsider the networked conditions in which we teach writing.
It sounds really odd, or seemingly obvious, to say that our students are and have bodies in our classrooms. But the podcast project pushes me to be more aware of this, to pay better attention, and to listen differently than I might otherwise have. And while these podcasts are mediated through various programs, manipulated and edited, they're intimate. They draw out my students and demonstrate compelling examples of vulnerability. So for me, the technology shows up in ways that don't actually distance us from each other or ourselves. Rather, our tools or our glowing rectangles offer us new ways to deeply listen and relate to each other, to be embodied writers.
I thought that was really interesting, just like juxtaposing the first cut
First, we want to thank a few non-humans that helped us along the way. We got plenty of support and even inventive inspiration for this podcast from software like Adobe's Audition, Apple's GarageBand, Google Docs, and even Dropbox. We would also be remiss not to thank the little room
where so much of this happened. Humanities, Room 374, you're great. The music in this chapter comes from Sebastian and Lucius and Mome. We also need to thank Cindy Self,
who really got us going. We learned the most, of course, from our hardworking, risk-taking, crazy fantastic GTAs, all of them. A huge thank you to Roberto Ascalon, Austin Van Kirk, Dana Patterson, Margaret Starry, Sarah Appleton,
Becky Bergesser, Tony Winkler, Rebecca Baker, Leanne Billmeyer, Jack Sykes, Rob Rich, and Rose Pettit. And thank you to all our first-year writers.
Thank you to all our first-year writers. Smile like a